Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Julian Emmanuel joins us now at BTIG, the Chief Equity and Derivatives Strategist. Julian, let's just start with the week we've just had and just pause for a moment. Monday, positive vaccine news, this cyclical rotation that everyone was looking for. We all want to live in the back half of 2021. It sounds so good. Then we're confronted with the reality of the next few days. Can you walk me through how you're navigating it? I've asked every single guest we've had in this spot that question every single day. What's your response?
It's incredibly challenging, no doubt. And, you know, I think to an outside observer or someone who landed from Mars, the idea that you could have profoundly great news on Monday and have a top in the market that looks to us like, you know, it could be the high for the year is very counterintuitive. But again, that's the world of the financial world. But the reality is that you have to get through this transition period from, the hope of the vaccine, whenever that is, with the reality of the fact that, you know, honestly, the right. virus is really raging out of control. And that's the challenge. And the markets are just trying to digest it. And for now, it's really a standoff, which is not a bad result, to be perfectly frank, given the way the cases are spiking.
I mean, I look at this, Julian, and I think of the great Luis Yamada, who would talk about distribution. We've been distributing within this noise through September and October. What's wrong with going flat for a while?
Nothing's wrong with it, actually. And from our point of view, you know, bull markets correct in various ways. You can have they correct in time, they correct in price. You know, literally, if you look at it, the Nasdaq topped on September 2nd, although the other indices made new all-time highs on Monday. This consolidation process has gone on for a couple of months. And from our point of view, again, sideways, really, given the news, would not be a bad thing at all, because we do think the setup for 2021 is quite positive.
Okay, Julian, cautious short-term, long-term, quite positive. What does that mean as an investor? More cash now, looking for an entry point?
No, I think what it means is that if you, first of all, we do believe in the cyclical rotation. So we think you should be reducing some of your exposure to high multiple, high growth, you know, technology-centric, the work-from-home names, because honestly, when you get to a point where the vaccine becomes closer to reality, that will cause an acceleration in this cyclical theme. Rotate into financials. We think healthcare is an exceptionally interesting proposition here, having been battered because of politics at trading at an extreme discount. If you've got gains, we think optionality is very inexpensive, downside protection, but in general, patience is what's required.
Well, let's talk about that optionality, Julian. I just wonder if a different strategy is the best approach here. It seems to me we've had a series of head fakes over the last 6 to 9 months. What you needed going into Monday was the optionality on a cyclical move and then cash out of it and go back to tech again. And it seems to me that that's worked repeatedly, not just over the last 6 to 9 months, but over the last several years. Every time we've had the rotation head fake, the people that have really benefited from that were the people that had the position going on into the head fake and then used everyone else to fade out of it. I caught up with Mike Collins of PGIM yesterday. He was doing exactly that in credit. He had the cyclical exposure going into this week, used the rally to sell it down. Julian, why is that not the better approach?
Because, again, from our point of view, the psychology factually began to change at the parabolic high in the Nasdaq on September 2nd. And we think that the market is giving you information when you look back to Monday, with the Nasdaq being the only major index that didn't make a new all-time high. And when you look toward next year, the hope of a Washington that's going to be centrist, that's likely going to get stimulus over the line, even if it unfortunately does have to wait till a new session of Congress, that might engage in infrastructure spending and really taking down the temperature of Washington, All of these things are going to backstop confidence. And we think you get this cyclical recovery that not only is in the U.S., but as we've seen, the monetary authorities in Europe, for one, are going to be as aggressive, if not more, than the U.S. And so you get the cyclical theme playing out in markets like Europe and Japan. It's just a change of psychology. And we've seen a massive momentum shift in the last week that we don't think investors should be ignoring.
Julian, how do you price in economic scarring that stems from what we're experiencing right now with the pandemic?
So that is really the challenge of the concept. And I think part of what that means is that, and this is typical coming out of recessions into recoveries, but it may be more exaggerated this time, is that you get a degree of multiple compression. Because if you get to a point where the next 3 to 6 months, you have permanent business closures, an increase in permanent job losses, that means your long-run growth potential shifts in, and the long-run, what used to be called NARU, shifts higher. And that's a different mindset, given the fact that there's an expectation that people think unemployment will eventually go back to 3.5 or 4%. And that's not going to be the reality if we get economic scarring.
Julian, Tom has been far too quiet for the past couple of minutes for my liking. Can we wind him up just a little bit? And can you give me your view on Judy Shouter potentially being confirmed to the Federal Reserve?
Really, John?
Well, John, I think it really just points to the fact that, Washington has been a bit too political and a bit too backward looking these last several months. We, like Jay Powell, have been adamant in the need for more stimulus simply because I think.
So backward looking into the 19th century, is that where you're heading, Julian?
Well, Williams Jennings Bryan didn't want to perish on the cross of gold. But, frankly, the gold window shut with Richard Nixon. And we need to look forward and we need to get stimulus and we need to talk about the issues that matter in 2021, not 1963.
And John, I can tell that Julian's dresser behind him there with a BTIG sign on it, he's got a stack of Krugerrands in that thing.
Julian, it's great to catch up. Julian Emmanuel there of BTIG. Thank you, sir.
He is one of our most acute voices on conservative, more long-term investment, and he has been right in this bull market. James Bevan, can you maintain your optimism with the change pandemic?
I certainly can, Tom. When I think about fiscal policy, the big question, as you have correctly articulated, is whether or not we would see more spending to get us out of the other side of the current economic downturn. And I believe, interestingly, the government will now be prepared to spend more precisely because the vaccine gives them confidence that there really will be an end to the COVID-19 crisis in due course. That, to me, suggests that we will see genuine economic recovery. We will see corporate earnings growth. We will see investors prepared to pay more. Because if I am correct that the central bank will continue to buy bonds, yields will stay low, well below the rate of inflation. That's great for the mathematics for equities. It's excellent for company balance sheets. And quite clearly, it's very supportive for consumers that in due course will want to be able to spend a lot more money.
James, what you describe is working here in the United Kingdom, that beautiful choreography between the Treasury and the Bank of England. Can you say the same thing about the US right now?
Well, very interestingly, I think there was a broad expectation that had there been a blue sweep, we would have seen Mr. Biden asking and getting perhaps $2.5 trillion to spend on new fiscal measures. And I equally anticipate that the Biden presidency, coupled with a Republican Senate, would have been far more tricky in terms of what could be spent, and perhaps no more than $500 trillion. However, now that we have clarity that there is a vaccine and therefore an end, I think that Mr. Biden will get an extra $1 trillion, and that will make all the difference.
A trillion, James? What gives you that confidence?
Well, I would say two things, John. I would say, first off, there is, I think, a broad cross-party acceptance in the States that the government has to do more to end the challenge. And I don't believe that the Republicans will wish to kill the US economy because it will play very badly for their future chances of election. I think the second issue is that there is a subtle change in the conversations that Jerome Powell is having about Federal Reserve policy. He's made it clear that he supports a greater equality within the US economy, and he's been very targeted in terms of his support of the bond market. So this is quantitative easing that is focused, that is challenging, that absolutely, I think, is going to be providing the base plate for continued low yields and therefore low-cost fiscal expansion.
How much do your market calls hinge on this expectation of fiscal support? I believe you're calling for the S&P to reach 3,800 by mid-2021 and 4,000 by the end of the year.
Yeah, I'm not overly dependent on fiscal support to get there, because the sorts of companies that I think that we should be investing in are high quality companies. I mean, you were talking prior to the break about the prospects for Disney. Disney, for me, is a world-class company, and I would take the recent share price weakness as an excellent entry opportunity for the long haul. Equally, if I were to think about some of the great companies in medical technology, I'm still a fabulous fan of Medtronic and Stryker, because these are companies that I think will rise from the ashes of share price markdowns to positively surprise shareholders.
James, this is incredibly important insight, folks. We haven't discussed this, and I'm going to say 10 or 15 days because of election 2020. On the healthcare play, everybody, it's simple. Buy Johnson & Johnson, and there's like three other names, Dow Components, et cetera. Take us beneath that. Tell us about not the specifics of Medtronic or Stryker, but the thematic play of those stocks given a Biden administration.
The first key issue is that as people get older, so medical care becomes more complex.
Really?
We are into issues like parts replacement for hips operations. We're into dialysis for people who have challenges with their kidneys. These are all issues where we will see an increasing spend in the years ahead. Now, in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis, so-called elective operations, those where people can choose if and when they have such operations, were essentially shelved. And inevitably, there was a big hit short-term earnings of people providing parts and facilities that could be described as elective. If I am correct, the vaccine leads to the gradual reopening of elective surgery and medicine in the States. So I think companies will benefit hugely.
James, will there be a roll-up of the industry? There's been roll-ups in other industries. What are we waiting for in the health space?
I certainly think there will be mergers and acquisitions activity because cash is cheap. I find it very interesting. People talk about the extraordinary performance of Alphabet, for example, and the FANGs. Actually, in recent years, Domino's Pizza, that came to the market at the same time in 2004, has thoroughly outperformed Alphabet. And the reason it has done so is it has spent cash and issued debt to buy back its own share. So it has magnified its earnings per share. The market has been pleased. If Alphabet had played the same game and had geared its balance sheet, it would really be reporting earnings per share twice the current level. And I think this issue of using cheap debt to fund M&A, to fund financial engineering, is going to continue so long as we have ample credit and low-cost debt.
James, I've got to jump in quickly because you sound so constructive. Just a final question from me on where you're playing things right now. You sound optimistic, yet you're not playing it through the European banks. Earlier this week, when the optimism returned, where did people go? The European banks. Why aren't you doing the same thing?
I think that European banks remain an accident waiting to happen. Negative interest rates mean that we have higher savings rates rather than more spending. It's extraordinarily difficult for a bank to make money in a climate of negative interest rates. And I see no expectation that the European Central Bank will come to the rescue.
James Bevan of CCLA, just laying it into the European banks at the end there. James, thank you. Great to catch up.
You went viral on Twitter, John, with hopium the other day. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine is the push back against hopium. He's in the reality of finding a vaccine. We'll look at that in a minute. Peter Hotez, can we have any vaccine for anybody in America within the vicinity of January?
Yeah, I think so. We certainly won't have all seniors vaccinated by January. What's going to happen now is, first of all, the phase 3 trial has to be completed for that Pfizer vaccine. There are other vaccines following. The Pfizer one will get the full spectrum of safety data and also the level of protection. Right now, we haven't seen whether this vaccine protects against serious infection or not. I hope that's the case. And also, we haven't seen the protection level in different groups, so we don't even know if it protects seniors yet. So we'll have to, all that information will come out towards the end of the year. Pfizer will likely request an emergency use authorization with the FDA. The FDA will take a couple of weeks to review it and certify right. that everything looks good. And then starting in January, if everything looks good, they could start potentially releasing vaccine. Pfizer says they'll have 50 million doses by the end of the year. But remember, in the U.S., it's only half of that's for the U.S., that's 25 million doses, and you require two doses of the vaccine. So in theory, you could start vaccinating around 12 million Americans starting around January.
Peter, Hotez and Botazzi, 8 months ago, a year ago, was talking up low-cost vaccines that don't need to be frozen to negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit. We use Fahrenheit, John, in America. Thank you. Dr. Hotez, where are we on a low-cost vaccine?
Well, thanks for asking. So we'll announce we're starting clinical trials in India in five sites, and then we can move pretty quickly and then right now Biological E, BioE in Hyderabad is producing 1 billion doses. So that's extraordinary. We've never made a billion of anything before. So we're very excited. This is a simple technology that's been around for almost 40 years. It uses the same technology used to make the recombinant hepatitis B vaccine, made locally in many countries. And hopefully it could be made for around $1 a dose or less. So we're very excited about it. It's looking really good. And hopefully that can fill up the areas where it's going to be hard to get that Pfizer vaccine out, because it does require that deep, deep freeze, which limits our ability to use that to vaccinate around the world, and also some of the production issues.
What
you're going to see is a pretty complex ecosystem of at least half a dozen different vaccines used all around the world.
And there definitely is a lot more hope, as some of these vaccines are shown to be effective, and yet we are seeing the pandemic worsen dramatically in some places in the United States, and timing really matters. What is the time frame for you, if it's not January for all seniors in the U.S., as Alex Azar says, what's the time frame for us to get a critical mass of people in the United States vaccinated?
I hope by Q2 we'll really move in that direction. So certainly by the summer, we'll be in much better shape than we are now. And it assumes that there are no bumps in the road, but of course there are always bumps in the road. And there are other vaccines coming behind it. So by the middle of next year, we're going to be in a much better position. And that's why I've been telling people to do everything you can to be careful now for the next few months, because things are going to get better. We're not asking for social distancing and masks in perpetuity. We'll eventually get to a better place, but just hang on and don't do things that are reckless and be careful and look after your loved ones for the next few months.
Doctor, many people share that view. Many people also who watch and listen to this program followed a panel yesterday with ECB President Christine Lagarde, the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell, and also the Governor of the Bank of England, Mr. Bailey. And at the end of that panel, they were asked what they think are the biggest risks right now. President Lagarde brought up the mink mutation in Denmark. Can you walk us through what you've learned from that in the past week or so, Doctor, and how concerned we should be, or shouldn't for that matter?
Well, remember, our RNA viruses, this is an RNA virus, they mutate. And so far, we've not seen any evidence that those mutations are affecting transmissibility or severity of illness, or the ability for those vaccines to cross protect. So, you know, this is a fast moving train. Things could change, and the things I'm saying today may look very different 3 or 4 months from now. But right now, I would say that the mutations that this virus undergoes on a regular basis are not my top flight concern. I'm more concerned that we can get some vaccine out to the population because, you know, in the U.S., we haven't really had a national control program. So there's a complete reliance on biotechnology solutions. Let's get the U.S. population vaccinated. We have the virologists working on constantly looking at the evolution of the virus. Hopefully those vaccines will still be effective. You know, one of the things that we're working on, we've been trying to get funding on for more than a decade, but the world has not been interested, is creating a universal coronavirus vaccine. So you know, just like there's work towards a universal flu vaccine, we've seen now SARS-1 in 2003, we've seen MERS in 2012, now we're seeing COVID-19, but guess what? We're gonna see COVID-25, we're gonna see COVID-28, we're gonna see COVID-34. This is a new normal. So if we don't have to rush like a little kid's soccer game towards the ball every time a new coronavirus emerges, it would be great to develop a universal coronavirus vaccine. And we're putting a lot of energy now into that goal.
Sobering words at the end there, Doctor. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you. Dr. Peter Hotez there of Baylor College of Medicine.
We can go Washington policy on BitDog, but we can't do that with Henrietta Trey. She's not up to speed on Bitcoin, but she is with Veda Partners on the path forward. You know, I look, Henrietta, at where we are now. Everybody wants to hear from their president, his supporters, his not supporters, et cetera. Is there any optimism of policy towards this pandemic and towards a government shutdown December 12th?
I see very small pockets of optimism. Unfortunately, we have to keep talking about elections, namely the two Senate races in Georgia, that could be a driver for conversations around a very small package of stimulus in the lame duck session. As you just pointed out, the continuing resolution to fund the government needs to pass by December 11th. And the two senators in Georgia are going to need to show that they're making some sort of progress on the coronavirus, especially as everybody heads home or tries to engage with their family members on Thanksgiving and the cases continue to skyrocket. I wonder, and I've heard directly from some folks in the various senators' offices in Georgia, that they'd like to take some votes on particularly extending the PPP program and potentially providing airline aid, given that Atlanta obviously is a huge airline hub.
Okay, so they got to win the vote in Hartsfield. I get it. What are we going to do about what is clearly the negotiated stumbling block, which is the big cities, the big towns across this nation?
Nothing until the first quarter of next year. I don't see a state and local aid package happening. I don't see aid to mass transit or public rail or anything like that. I think that's a first quarter 2021 event. I think it needs to be done before March. We saw the 2009 Recovery Act get passed. I think it was February 17th. That's exactly the kind of momentum that President Biden will need to bring to the table in order to get 60 votes out of the Senate in the first quarter of next year. But no big aid package is passing before the next Congress is sworn in.
So that's the side in the domestic sphere when we talk about the fiscal backdrop for the United States. Let's talk international. Let's talk China coming out and congratulating Joe Biden for being the next president of the United States. They had actually restrained themselves from doing so. How coincidental is it that this comes right after President Trump announces some further restrictions on investments in Chinese entities?
Not at all. I mean, you guys nailed it in your last segment. I don't think it's remotely coincidental that the acknowledgement of President-elect Biden having won the election came and coincided almost exactly in the same process, you know, 12 to 24 hours later from every phase in the U.S.-China trade war, whether it was tariffs or announcements around Huawei or export control restrictions. Every time the president did anything there, about 12 hours later, we'd get a response from China. And that's exactly what we got last night. I think the most important cabinet official to watch in 2021, you know, people are concentrating on Treasury and Commerce and State, and I respect that. I get it. I think the most exciting is who's going to be the next U.S. Trade Representative. That person is going to inherit, you know, over $300 billion worth of tariffs on China, and that's going to be, as soon as we get past the stimulus conversation, I think probably the only topic in D.C., aside from regulatory changes, that we have for the next 3.5 years.
That's where I wanted to go. How does Joe Biden respond to this? Because, frankly, there's bipartisan agreement on taking a harder line with China. Does he embrace this, or does he push back and try to indicate that he's going to take a similarly hard line as President Trump?
There was a line that I heard from the chief of staff in the Ways and Means Committee on the Trade Subcommittee a couple months back, and effectively she said, you know, when we see the president imposing tariffs on China, we think, well, great, he's doing the hard work for us. Now, when President Biden comes in, he is in a position to offer the carrots and not necessarily need to impose more sticks. So as China and the U.S. engage and start to talk about real fundamental forms, not, you know, buying more soybeans or more pork bellies, but actually instituting intellectual property theft changes and forced tech transfer, they can walk down the tariffs eventually. We've heard from the Biden transition team repeatedly now that they're going to first focus on domestic priorities. So stimulus all day in the first quarter. But as we get beyond that and we start to, you know, re-engage with China or the EU or Japan or the UK and hash out these trade agreements, there needs to be a substantive discussion that I think will dominate the next 3 years.
Henrietta, thank you so much. Henrietta Trey is a policy briefing. She's with Veda Partners. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.